welcome to Senate Finance. It is, here we go, October. It is February the 19th, 2014 at 5 o'clock, about 5 after 5. And we're going to have an overview of some of the issues surrounding SB 138. We do not have the bill before us. This is an informational meeting. We anticipate that the bill will get to us next week sometime. But I just wanted to make sure the committee was up to speed, although I know a lot of you are and have invested a lot of time in learning about this. I thought it would be good to get some perspectives maybe that that we hadn't had so far. So the first person that I asked to come and just kind of give us a general overview and his thoughts on all things gas line related is Larry Persily. Larry, if you'd like to come up and, you know, the drill, state your name and affiliation, and tell us what's on your mind. Again, make sure everybody knows Senator Fairclough is at the table, along with Senator Dunleavy, Senator Hoffman, Senator Meyer, and myself, Senator Kelly.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Larry Persily. I'm the head of the Federal Alaska Gas Line Project Office. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today at Senate Finance, and I hope my comments are useful and answer some of your questions. I guess what I'd like to start with this time is to explain why this time may turn out differently than all the other attempts at an Alaska gas pipeline project throughout the years. But first, I want to share with you a couple of examples of Washington taking notice of what's happening on this project. And I know normally Alaskans don't like to hear that the federal government is watching over our resource development, but this time it's okay, really. It's one of these trust me, but I didn't want to use that line, trust me, I'm from the federal government. I presented an update on the Alaska LNG project last week at the Department of Interior. I was speaking to the Alaska Interagency Working Group, which was created by a presidential executive order almost 3 years ago to track and help coordinate the work of federal resource agencies at onshore and offshore energy projects in Alaska. As I started talking about the Alaska Gas Line project, people actually paid attention. They asked good questions. They've heard about Alaska Gas many, many times before through the years. Their agencies have spent a lot of time on the many false starts we've had on this project through the decades, but they had heard and they had read recently that this time might be different, and they were eager to know what was happening. They had heard that all of the players are working together on the same project, and they're spending serious money to determine if Alaska's time finally has come. Between budget cuts, retirements, other staffing reductions, however, federal resource management and regulatory agencies just don't have spare time for another false start, like they went through just a few years ago with a proposed pipeline from Alaska to serve North American markets. You know, though sponsors of that project certainly worked in good faith trying to put the deal together, shale gas put an end to it. We know that now, but not before federal agencies had spent a lot of time on permitting issues, rights of way, scoping meetings, reviewing thousands of pages of draft resource reports for an environmental impact statement. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the Department of Energy, the Bureau of Land Management, Army Corps of Engineers, others, have more than enough work on their desks without an Alaska gas line. FERC alone has several lower 48 LNG export terminals on their work list for environmental reviews, EISs. The Department of Energy has 24 LNG export applications waiting for review, including the applications from the existing ConocoPhillips plant at Nikiski. You know, federal agencies are the same as Alaskans. They don't want another false start on an Alaska gas line project, but every one of those agencies, when I talked to them last week, is ready to work on this project just as soon as an application hits their desk. They would like to know that this time we have a real shot at making it work. And I told them the same thing I'm going to tell you, and this is coming from someone who, I swear, I'm still cynical and skeptical about life, but I'm going to tell you this, like I say, same thing I told them. This time very well may be different for the Alaska Gas Line. If the markets perform as expected, if the companies and the state can keep the cost down, if the financial terms look good to all parties, I think gas would flow in the 2020s down that line. And another non-skeptic in Washington in the federal government is Adam Siminski, who is head of the Energy Information Administration at the U.S. Department of Energy. He said in an Energy Newsletter interview this week, "We think the economics ultimately will favor construction of an LNG facility in Alaska." One of the more positive statements coming out of the Energy Information Administration for a long time on this project. So why this time? Why might this be different? And I'll tell you what's working in our favor. Global LNG demand is the strongest growth industry for energy in the world. Between nuclear plant shutdowns in Japan and Korea, choking coal pollution in China, population, economic growth in India, China, and elsewhere across Southeast Asia, high oil prices that make LNG look affordable by comparison, they all add up to a strong demand for LNG in the Asian market. The International Energy Agency predicts global demand for natural gas to grow twice as fast as oil over the next 20 years. Others predict even stronger growth for gas. Most of the world's gas trade is by pipeline, but LNG is building and building at an even faster pace than pipeline deliveries. Now, many analysts are talking of about a 5% to 6% annual growth rate for LNG demand through 2020, slowing down a little bit to 2 to 3% growth range through 2035, that's per year. What that adds up to, what that means is the equivalent of a new good-sized LNG export terminal will need to start up almost every year somewhere in the world to meet that demand growth. In addition to market growth, older LNG supply contracts are expiring, and some of those older export plants are running low on reserves. Just this week, Egypt, which has been an LNG exporter for the past 10 years, announced it will need to import LNG for the next several years as gas production is falling short of domestic demand. Now, all of which means that export project developers are chasing not only that new demand growth, but replacement contracts for declining reserves from other projects. Someone is going to win that business, and it will be the lowest cost, stable, predictable suppliers. You know, the potential competitors for Alaska have their own strengths and weaknesses, as does Alaska. And make no doubt about it, there are a lot of potential competitors. There is no shortage of natural gas in the world. But I'd like to talk about our competitors' weaknesses for a few minutes to give you a sense of there is hope, there is possibility, we have a real shot at this. Australia, certainly people hear about it. There are 7 LNG export projects under construction in Australia that are set to open over the next 3 years. But most of that gas is already sold on long-term contracts. Those projects are not our competition for deliveries starting in the 2020s. New terminals, new projects, expansions in Australia face tough hurdles. Cost overruns on those projects under construction have got companies worried about repeating history. Domestic consumers in Australia are seeing price increases for natural gas, which is being drawn from the local market to feed the higher-priced export markets. Dow Chemical last week made headlines saying it could not get new gas supply contracts it needs for investments in Australia. And some local jurisdictions in Australia have imposed drilling restrictions on coal bed gas reserves, which are feeding 3 of those export terminals under construction. Russia is another competitor we hear about. Russia has just 1 operating export plant. There's talk of expanding it. Russia has another plant under construction and thoughts of 2 more. The expansion talk at Sakhalin 2, which is led by operators Gazprom and partner Shell, is dependent on sufficient gas reserves to feed to justify that expansion. Gazprom is also talking about building an LNG terminal at Vladivostok in the Russian Far East. Great location for marketing. It's a short, very short tanker trip from Vladivostok to Japan, to Korea, China, Taiwan, 4 of the biggest LNG players. but it will take a 2,500-mile pipeline to move the gas from Russia's interior to the coast to that terminal. The field development costs alone and the pipeline are estimated at $40 billion, not counting the liquefaction terminal. To make the economics work on a project that size, Russia really needs to extend that pipeline project and sell gas into China to get enough volume, enough economies of scale. China and Russia have agreed on everything but the price for the gas, which essentially means they've agreed on nothing. Yeah. And just on a sidelight, this is a big project, a big dream in Russia, this 2,500-mile pipeline. So Gazprom actually ran a contest to name the project. The winning name was Power Siberia. I guess that's a good name. What I found interesting is, big country, a lot of people live in Russia. They only got 130 entries in this contest, and I guess I figure it's because the prize was a trip for two to Siberia. You know, you got to figure the prize has got to be good enough or no one enters. And you look at the fine print, it didn't say round trip. It just said trip for two to Siberia. So separately, you've got Rosneft and ExxonMobil. They're doing due diligence for an LNG plant called Sakhalin 1. They have issued a contract, but only for their initial feed work, front-end engineering design. In Russia's Arctic, a terminal is under construction. It's called Yamal LNG. To give you an idea of where it is, it's about halfway between Nome and Iceland. Right. It's sort of out there in the middle of nowhere up in the Arctic. That project is estimated at $27 billion. The sponsors talk of making the first deliveries in 3 or 4 years. Here's the tricky part. The hard part for Yamal is the Northern Sea route to Asia, which will be passable for LNG tankers to serve Asian customers, but it's only going to be passable a few months a year, and even then only with government-funded nuclear-powered icebreakers as escorts. The rest of the year, their plan is to ship the LNG aboard ice-class tankers to European ports, where they will transfer the LNG to less expensive standard tankers, and then those tankers will take the long way to Asia, down the European coast, through the Mediterranean Sea, through the Suez Canal, across the Indian Ocean into Asia. You look at that map and you realize the economic challenges that project faces, plus the main sponsor, a Russian company called Novatek, has never built or operated an LNG plant. Canada, a little closer to home, another competitor, multiple proposals, about a dozen, give or take. None have all of their government authorizations or a final investment decision. None have cleared the consultation process with every First Nation in the area and along the pipeline route. And the developers in British Columbia that are talking about price are emphatic that they need oil-linked LNG pricing or something comparable to cover the sizable development costs of their projects. There is no Prudhoe Bay production facility in British Columbia's Horn River and Montney shale gas plays that would produce the gas to feed the terminals at Kitimat and Prince Rupert. They're going to have to build it, and gas is going to have to pay for it, not oil. The pipelines that would move that gas from northeast British Columbia to the coast are as long as 525 miles, and they must go through two mountain ranges, Rocky Mountains and Coast Mountains. One of the possible routes into Prince Rupert takes the pipeline offshore for up to 75 miles, and their choice is to either cross an old mine tailings disposal site or a mollusk habitat bed that's important to First Nations people. Sort of pick your environmental headache, mine tailings or mollusk habitat. You know, meanwhile, the British Columbia government is negotiating a new LNG export tax with project sponsors. That legislation has been delayed until fall, and the companies are saying, hey, no decisions till we know the tax. One other foreign competitor, Tanzania, Mozambique, awful lot of gas. More than 100 trillion cubic feet have been discovered offshore of the East African nations, but minimal infrastructure in those two countries. They're still developing their oil and gas tax laws, their fiscal regimes, and certainly local poverty could be an issue for developers and politics. Closer to home, lower 48 states, awash in natural gas. A lot of companies want to get in the export business, but it is a tough political battle. You're pitting oversupply and low prices at home versus the free market and whether you should sell to our trading partners. the U.S. Department of Energy. Federal approval is required for any exports from this country. The Department of Energy has approved 6 export licenses totaling 8.5 billion cubic feet a day of gas, and that's equal to almost 12% of current U.S. gas production. The unknown is if and when and under what conditions the department might start to close down or delay export approvals in the lower 48. Regardless what the government does, the only terminals are going to be built. And even though they approved 6, I don't think 6 get built, much less the rest that are waiting, but the only ones that are going to be built are the ones that have buyers and can get financing, and just one so far is under construction at Sabine Pass, Louisiana. Another issue for lower 48 exports include the cost overruns for construction of the Panama Canal expansion, which is essential for getting those tankers out of the Gulf Coast and into the Pacific. One of the Gulf Coast LNG export project sponsors said this week that Asian buyers are starting to put off long-term contracts for U.S. lower 48 gas because of the delay in knowing just how much it's going to cost for tolls to move ships through the expanded canal. Local opposition over environmental and safety concerns, not that noticeable in the Gulf Coast, certainly long history of oil and gas on the U.S. Gulf Coast, but environmental safety issues extremely visible for terminals that are proposed for the Oregon coast and the Maryland coast on Chesapeake Bay. And my point in all this is that Alaska, like every other proposed project, all of our competitors, they all have their own problems, their own disadvantages, their own issues to solve. It was easy, they would have been built already. The winners, the LNG export projects around the world that get built, will be the ones that can solve the problems, the ones that can hold down their costs, the ones that can convince buyers they will start up on time with competitive prices. But the winners will be built. The pre-feed and feed work, as we're learning, front-end engineering and design, is a key part of that effort. The more you do up front, the better the odds of avoiding surprises during construction. And in a brief plug for our office, we issued a report today on just what are pre-feed and feed, why they're so important, and it's available at our website, arcticgas.gov. So to sort of close, what are Alaska's advantages in being one of those winning projects? And the advantages for us are meaningful and they're very substantial. It's a much shorter tanker run from Nikiski to Japan, 1 week versus 3 weeks from the U.S. Gulf Coast. LNG tanker charter rates are running $75,000 to $100,000 a day. Time is money, and big money at those rates if it's a 1 week run instead of 3. Or if you're going to do owner-operated tankers, certainly a lot less capital tied up if you don't need as many ships. Alaska's gas reserves are proven. They're already being produced, and it's important to buyers to know that the gas that they're committing to buy for 15 or 20 or 25 years actually exists. No risks. We have low production costs compared to greenfield projects in British Columbia, Australia, East Africa. Oil will carry the infrastructure costs in Alaska, where we've had almost 40 years of producing on the North Slope and more than 40 years experience exporting gas from Cook Inlet. Liquefaction compressors run much more efficiently at cold temperatures, up to 15% more efficient, less gas consumed in the process than in a warm climate. But back to reality, we have disadvantages in Alaska, and they are just as substantial and just as meaningful. We have high construction costs, seasonal construction limitations, such as pipeline trenching only in the winter. The summer-only sea lifts of material to the North Slope make life harder. Environmental considerations, wetlands, air quality standards, mitigation expenses are an issue here. The cost of an 800-mile pipeline to Tidewater, our competitors don't have one that long or that expensive. Another disadvantage, I guess, something everybody changes, markets could change. Japan could restart nuclear power. China could say the heck with air pollution and just burn coal, not bother going ahead with their plans to convert to natural gas. And a serious issue, and this is not a comment on legislation, but we all know anything dealing with oil and gas politics is a tough sell in this state. We've got to resolve this if this project's going to go ahead. Speaking for the federal government, we are ready for the permitting work, but making the finances work Well, that's up to the project sponsors, the companies, and the state. The rewards to the state of a successful gas line project include substantial public revenue for decades, the lowest cost for moving gas to Alaskans, and an industry commitment to keep North Slope oil and gas flowing for decades. The risks of a state investment in a project, certainly construction cost overruns, especially if you're facing budget deficits, and there is the possibility that the project will not make as much money as people projected or as people want, but long term it will still make money if it's built. And I can't help you with those political risks, those fiscal risks, other than to say the LNG world is competitive, but it's not an impossible market. We could get in there. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm certainly happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Larry. Appreciate it. I just want to make a quick comment that Senator Bishop and Senator Fairclough are going to have to take off, like right now, I think, for the Resources Committee hearing on this very bill. And Senator Olson joined us, and I think I did not mention, Senator Fairclough, that you joined us. I didn't mention that Senator Olson and Senator Bishop joined us. So I think I've got everybody covered. The whole committee is here, for the record. So questions? We'll wait till we'll just take a quick break at ease. You have a question. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Larry, for that presentation. Larry, or Mr. Pursley, I'm just curious, who's going to oversee the pipeline? Is this FERC or RCA or both?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer. Under federal law, FERC will take the environmental and safety review on the liquefaction project, the plant itself. There's no question about that. Some ambiguity, 2005 law nailed it. FERC will do the EIS and issue an authorization for construction and operation of the liquefaction plant. Under that federal law, FERC has the option of asserting that same environmental and safety review all the way up the line as far as they want to go. FERC will not regulate the tariffs on the liquefaction plant or on the pipeline because there's no interstate commerce in there, and the law precludes FERC from getting in the tariff regulation business on a liquefaction plant. But that pipeline is not interstate commerce. It has to do with different sections of the Natural Gas Act. So to answer your question, FERC will do an EIS, certainly will be in charge for the liquefaction plant. It's up to FERC if they want to do the pipeline too. It makes sense to have one EIS because it really is in one project. FERC will have to wait till it gets an application and then at that time decide.
On that point, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Even though it's not interstate commerce and even though it's international commerce, FERC will still not get involved with that?
No. As a matter of law, Congress has told FERC, and FERC has some decisions where it's, well, first of all, FERC has acknowledged that LNG is traded differently than gas in the law 48 through the chair, Senator Olson, that LNG projects only get built with long-term fiscal certainty, which means you have contracts up front and tariff regulation on an annual basis is going to get in the way of that. But the law that gave FERC that absolute authority over the environmental safety review siting of liquefaction plants told them you can't condition these things on tariff regulations. It's just...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Meyer.
Yeah, to continue, The price of gas in the open market seems to be all over the place. I've seen as low as $6 and up to 16, maybe even higher. You know, if everything works as planned and hoped, what would you anticipate our gas would go for, and where do we make any money at that price?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer.
Because the prices seem to be downward trending.
And you're talking about LNG prices, right, in Asia, not, yes, U.S. prices. There are a lot of old contracts out there in the Asian market, and some buyers got some very good prices. There are some projects in Australia that went on the market, and they needed buyers. It was a much different market than it was today. Not so many projects out there. So there's some old projects where out of Australia, out of Yemen, out of Equatorial Guinea, where gas is being sold pretty cheap. Those countries are trying to renegotiate prices. Yemen LNG recently negotiated on a five-year opener with their contract with the Korea Gas, much higher prices. So some of the old contracts were linked to oil, but they might have had price caps. China also is a beneficiary of a very low-cost contract from Indonesia, so it may have been linked to oil up to $30 or $40 a barrel, and then it stopped because years ago we all thought 30 or 40 was heaven for oil prices. We never dreamed about $100. You never thought of it could go that high. The contracts, the newer ones, are the ones that you most often think about, linked to oil, at current prices, $14, $15, $16 per million BTU. So what Alaska could get, certainly the buyers in Asia know there are a lot of new suppliers chasing after their business, and they're certainly playing one off against another, so it's the most dependable buyers with the lowest cost that will get contracts. Current spot price is around $18 per million BTU, I believe, in Asia. You're not going to get that price, but you'll do a lot better than some of the old Russian contracts at six or Indonesian contracts at three, because you can't produce it at that cost. Those are old projects.
And this may be an unfair question. What do you think we would have to make our project economical?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer. And I don't know what it's going to cost per million BTU to run gas in the liquefaction plant. I've certainly seen Black and Veatch and the legislative consultants' estimates, but I don't know what that final cost is going to be. I guess it's also a question, the state as an owner of the gas and the producers, how much do they want as a netback? Are they willing to get into the market at a lower netback and hopefully ride the market as it improves, as prices rise in 30, 40 years? But all the numbers I've seen tell me we can be competitive with the other projects. They've got their own cost problems, their own other hurdles, their own dependability issues, but it's not going to be today's spot price of $18. If I can, Mr. Chairman, the Wood Mackenzie National Energy Consultancy Firm did a report for the Alaska Gas Line Port Authority a couple years ago where they said the state would make, I think, $500 billion over the life of the project. What they did is took that day's very high spot price for LNG in Asia and then applied an annual inflation to it of 3%. So 30 years out, I think they said the gas was going to, we were going to get $45 per million BTU. Well, of course, with set fixed expenses. Expenses don't rise, but the price of the commodity goes up 3% a year. Well, of course, under that, you're going to make $500 billion, but it's monopoly money because no one's going to sign a contract like that. It was a very misleading study. My point being, I think if it gets built, you get a decent price, but not today's spot price. You're going to get a contract price.
Senator Meyer?
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And one last question. Again, try and keep this at this meeting at a high level. But I think I mentioned this one other time in another committee meeting. This just seems like deja vu. Maybe I've lived in the state too long. Maybe I'm getting too old. But, you know, there's been the Port Authority. There's been ANGDA. There's been AGEA. There's been a Bullet Line. There's been Denali. And now we have this one. What makes this one different? Why are you optimistic about this one?
Go ahead, Lee.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, what changes the market? Until about 2008, Asian market wasn't paying a high enough price for LNG that you could have covered the cost of producing the gas, cleaning it, piping it, liquefying it, and getting it to Asia. Anyone before that would have lost money on every molecule they sent to Asia. So the market's because they're tied to oil, and oil has gone up, and there's so much demand, and this acceptance that the only way you finance these things is with long-term contracts at a sufficient price to cover the capital costs, it looks like the market is there, the price structure is there. The question now is, can we be competitive on price with all those other people chasing the same market?
I said that would be my last one, but this is just right a follow-up to it. Okay. Could it be, too, that this one is different in the sense that it's a partnership, that we are actually partnering with the industry? And I guess I've also been public about that, saying that I think that's the best way for the state to go after pipeline. But also, too, it's a little risky, I think, in the sense that the oil companies have other options. So you could get partway down this process, and they might say, hey, this is too risky, or it's not panning out like we want. We're going to abandon this project and go somewhere else. We don't have any other options.
Right. Through the chair, Senator Meyer, you're right. We don't. This is our mother load up there on the North Slope, and we need to develop oil and gas to have a sustainable economy. Companies can go somewhere else. Certainly, I mean, I can tell you people in Washington have noticed this time is different because you do have the three major producers holding hands. They don't love each other. You know, certainly, federal officials know that. The companies are very competitive. They don't always get along, but on this one, they seem to be walking in the same direction, not exactly to a military cadence, but they're stepping at the same speed, holding hands in the same direction. That gives people some hope, gives me some hope. And between that and the market, and that maybe after 40 years of oil production on the North Slope, the economics are such, if this project goes ahead, if they make a final investment decision, the companies can then take those 34 trillion cubic feet of gas reserves on the North Slope and book them on their balance sheets as reserves. Until there's a commitment to a pipeline, they cannot book them as reserves. 34 trillion cubic feet of gas is about 6 billion barrels of oil equivalent. If you can put 6 billion barrels of oil on your collective balance sheets, that certainly is a prize for any company trying to look to the future. That also works in our favor.
Thank you.
You talked a lot about the disadvantages that our competitors have, and you also talked a little bit about the disadvantages that we have, kind of putting everybody on the same even playing field. Your gut is we're ahead of the others, or in about the same place, or it's a kind of an apples to oranges comparison because everybody's problems are different? Did that question make sense?
Yeah, it does, okay. Mr. Chairman. We're ahead in that we know the gas is there. There's no exploration.
Right.
We're ahead that we've got the facilities built and operating companies. And we're behind in that it's going to take longer to build it in Alaska than it would somewhere else because of Arctic conditions, environmental issues, winter-only construction, the size of the project, the long lead time. I think probably about even, I guess I would say. We're ahead on some, behind on others. Certainly some of the issues they're facing in Canada where there's a lot of gas in northeast British Columbia, no question about it, but getting it to the coast is not going to be that easy. There are some environmental problems. There's First Nations issues. British Columbia, the government just this week rolled out some aspects of the tax proposal, but they won't have the details till fall. And what their proposal is a low tax in the early years until the project sponsors have recovered their capital expenditures, and then the tax ramps up. So it starts off at about 1.5% of net, and then after cost recovery goes to 7%. This is a different way of partnering. You know, we're looking at partnering here as investors. They're partnering by reducing their tax take until the cost recovery. So they've got to work that out, and as we know, no oil and gas debate ever goes quickly.
So there are a lot of contracts out there that are maturing, and that puts us in a competitive advantage. But many of those are spoken for. I think you said down in Australia that they aren't really, you wouldn't really even consider them one of our competitors because the projects that they have going already are linked up with some contracts that have matured and They have their long-term contracts. I'm not sure if you made the point that they were connecting with mature contracts.
Mr. Chairman, so of these projects being built in Australia, they're coming online 2014, 15, 16, 17. They're coming online because when they made their final investment decision, they locked up 60, 70% or more of their supply in long-term contracts. So they're not our competitors in the sense that they've already sold most of their gas. You know, they've held some back for spots, still looking for some other sales. But when BP, Conoco, Exxon, State of Alaska goes out and tries to sign contracts for 2023, 2024, whatever it is on, we're looking at utilities that have unmet needs from that period forward, and our competitors are going to be other unsanctioned projects also trying to strike their deals so they can make those sanctions, those decisions.
The Australian projects that you described with the problems that they have, any possibility that they can't deliver?
Mr. Chairman, no. The seven under construction, I believe, will all be completed, some under varying degrees of cost overruns and delays. And I think the ones that are having cost overruns, they will still be profitable projects. Over the life of them, they will still make a lot of money for their project sponsors. Just make less money in the early years than they thought because they're going to have more capital to recover. But they will still be profitable projects.
How much are we depending on for the future for a healthy Chinese economy?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Japan buys a lot more LNG currently than China. But long-term, when you look at a growing economy and population, industrial development, a lot of LNG project sponsors look toward China. So that's a sizable chunk of the market. China has other options, not just burning coal. China gets about half of its imported gas by pipeline from Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan. So China's going to look at where is it cheaper, pipeline or LNG, but also China's physically so immense, just because they can bring pipeline gas in from Turkmenistan to one side of the country doesn't mean it's economical to move it all the way across China. It may be more economical to bring LNG into their coastal communities. So growth is a key part of this demand.
Do you have any insights on how this is going to be financed, kind of from a 30,000-foot view?
Mr. Chairman, the projects that are under construction in Australia and Papua New Guinea, and Cheniere Energy at Sabine Pass, Louisiana, once you have those binding long-term contracts,
the money will come.
People line up, whether it's commercial banks, whether it's U.S. Export-Import Bank, whether it's the equivalent of the Export-Import Bank from other nations, there is financing, but it's not just one. I mean, you'll see a dozen or two dozen lenders in there at different levels. No one is going to take all the risk on this, but there is financing, and current interest rates, it's relatively affordable.
Right.
Spoken as someone who took out a 16% mortgage once in 1982. And that was a bargain in 1982, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I remember. Senator Dunleavy?
Through the Chair. Larry, is it safe to say that some of Australia's customers and ours won't overlap? In other words, is it safe to say that India would be a customer for Australia gas more so than ours would be because of the proximity? And where we may overlap is your China, your Korea possibly, but we're not going to compete with Australia for India, are we?
Well, through the Chair, Senator Dunleavy, yes, no, certainly if I've got a project in Australia, it's a lot shorter tanker run to India, and that gives me a competitive cost advantage over bringing it in from the U.S. Gulf Coast or Alaska or British Columbia or Vladivostok or Yamal in Russia. But I guess we're competitors in that in 2012, the total global trade in LNG was about 32 billion cubic feet, growing quite a bit. But still, you look at that, and if we've got 2.5 billion cubic feet we're trying to get in there, that's a sizable chunk of that market. I would expect that the producers here would be trying to sell everywhere they could on the Pacific Rim. Countries, I think we also need to remember the buyers don't want to be tied to just one supplier. You don't want to be utility wholly dependent on Australia or the U.S., and you certainly don't want to be wholly dependent on Putin in Russia. That's just not good business. So they like that diversity in their portfolio. They like a little bit from different places. So if there's a problem, someone else can fill their needs. And also a diversity in pricing. Maybe some is linked to oil, maybe some to U.S. energy, maybe some is a blend. Just like with our investment portfolio with the permanent fund, you don't want to just bet on one thing.
I just ask one more, and this was not part of your presentation, but you just reminded me of something that's kind of has me scratching my head. I've heard of various times that our gas has been recycled two or three times and the liquids have been stripped out and sent down the pipeline. But then again, I hear from other people that that's not the case, that we have liquids and that's why buyers want it, because we have very rich gas. I've heard we only have ethane left in it to be stripped out for plastics, and I've heard others say, no, we have four or five different gases. What is the situation of our gas right now?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, actually our gas is, as they look out to 2020s and beyond for this project, from a BTU value is perfectly suited for Japan. Yes, the heavier gas liquids, the pentanes and butanes, what they have been able to strip out with in the past 30-some years, they have taken out as liquids, put into taps, sold in the liquids market, and made money, and the state has shared in those profits. But the methane, mostly, and the ethane, what's left in there is a high heat, high BTU gas that is perfectly suited for the Japanese market. It's higher than the U.S. market. If you were to sell North Slope gas into North American market, you'd have to take out the ethane. You'd have to water down the BTU content so it would work in furnaces and boilers in the lower 48, but it's perfect.
And one last follow-up. Is the Australian gas, is it mainly a coal-bed methane type, or is it a combination?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, of the six land-based projects in Australia, half of those are conventional gas. The other half are coal-bed methane gas, which does not have a high enough BTU content for the Japanese market. So they're going to have to either spike it with propane or other gas liquids to get the BTU value up, or they're going to have to adjust their burners and use it for, you can certainly take a gas-fired power generator and adjust it to run at a lower BTU value, but that makes the gas worth a little bit less because you're not getting as much energy off of it. And then you might have to have separate tanks to segregate that gas from the higher BTU gas from other customers. So three of those projects are coal-bed methane, and they are a lower BTU value.
Any other questions? Larry, I really appreciate this. It's very good for the committee to get these kind of larger views of things. Sometimes we jump right into the weeds, and we don't get the history behind it. But that's very valuable to me, and I hope it has been for the rest of the committee. And thanks. Your report that you put out was very good. We read through it.
Thank you, Senator. And any questions, direct them my way. And if I'm wrong in anything, the good thing about the federal government is we're immune from litigation. You can't sue us for anything I said.
I once worked for a guy that they used to say, if I'm going to be wrong, it's going to be out loud and in great detail.
I have the whole federal government to protect me if I'm wrong. I got no risk.
Thanks a lot, Larry. Appreciate it.
I'm going to take just a real brief at ease here, and then we're going to have Ms. Potavel, with Black and Beach. Would you want to come up and get yourself ready, and then I'm going to take just a quick at ease, and we'll be back in a few minutes.
We're back on the record. And we're going to hear from Ms. Podoval from Black & Veatch. I think I mentioned, you were in the room when I mentioned that Senator Bishop and Senator Fairclough are actually in a resources hearing regarding this topic right now. They actually have the bill before them. We don't. We're just trying to get some information at this point. And your name is Deepa?
That's correct.
As I understand, you're going to talk about the financing picture here and about the kind of a real high-level view of financing and ownership and those kinds of things. That's correct?
I'm focusing on the heads of agreement of the two main documents that you have, that you will have in front of you.
Thank you. Go ahead and state your name for the record, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Deepa Podoval. I'm a principal with Black & Veatch. I'm here in my capacity as the consulting firm that has supported the administration with economic analysis as well as commercial support. What I'm going to talk about today is starting from a royalty study, the North Slope royalty study that was commissioned by DNR last year, which looked at different aspects of the LNG market as well as a specific project, and made some recommendations in putting the heads of agreement that the administration has entered into with the producers as well as TransCanada within the context of the recommendations of that study. I want to recognize that my colleague Jason DeStichter is on the phone and available to answer questions as needed, but I intend to walk through the slides.
My apologies, Jason. I do have you on the sheet here, and we will throw to you from time to time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On slide 3 here, what I wanted to underline is just why we are here and why the Alaska LNG project is important for Alaskans. And what we're showing are forecasted revenues from North Slope oil and gas, both with and without the Alaska LNG project. And so the blue line is showing a forecast that's based on DOR's estimate of oil production on the North Slope and what revenues associated with that would be. And the green line shows an Alaska LNG project coming online in 2024. And what it shows is that the LNG project can bring in revenues of $4 to $4.5 billion incrementally to the state above what the current forecast would be from the North Slope just based on oil production. And so it just helps to put in context for us what the opportunity can be from the project. Now, talking about the heads of agreement, the timeline and the development process for the Alaska LNG project is laid out here. And the first step that we're contemplating at this point is entering into a pre-FEED, and Larry referred to it as well in his testimony here. But it's the initial version of your front-end engineering and design work. This is where you try and scope the project and you're working in concentric circles to get more and better information on the project's design and its cost, and the pre-FEED is the first step towards getting there. And that's contemplated to take about 18 months. Depending on the outcome of this legislative session, it could kick off mid-2014 and go through 2015. Next comes the FEED process, which is where the detailed engineering will be worked out, and the cost estimates for the project will be available at a much more granular level at that point. And that's anticipated to take anywhere from 2 to 3 years, including some of the permitting that work that gets done as that part of the process. At that point, you reach a decision point, which is the final investment decision. Somewhere between now and the end of FEED, these parties will have finalized their commercial agreements. And so they would have identified who the buyers for Alaska LNG would be, entered into sales and purchase agreements with those buyers. And so you, at that point, you have a pretty good estimate of what your costs are from the project and what your revenue stream can be. And that's the point that allows them to take an investment decision and say, this is a project that can be economic for each of our companies. And then you get into the construction, which for most projects is about 4 to 5, and it, you know, it could be a little longer here in Alaska, and we've seen a number of large projects suffer from delays. Putting in context what the expenditures would be for each of these different stages, at pre-FEED, we're talking about a very small proportion of the total project cost being at stake. It's, you know, somewhere in the range of 1%, 1 to 2% of costs. The millions of dollars of estimates that we're showing here would be the state's investment, assuming that you have TC in the mix or not, and what portion of equity you would take in the project. That reflects the range that's shown here. But in the first stage, like I said, it's about 1 to 2% of the total state's investment. You get to FEED, and you're spending another 3% at that point. And the big spend comes after you've taken that final investment decision, by which you have honed in and resolved a lot of the uncertainties around the project that can be resolved before you get to the construction. And that's where you spend, you know, more than 95% of the project's dollars. What the HOA contemplates is taking this process through the pre-FEED. Generally, in project development, it works through a stage-gated approach, and so you pass through one stage, and then all of the parties agree whether they want to go to the next stage or not. And at each stage, the parties are making commitments for spending the dollars that come in the next phase. And so the HOA is consistent with that approach for large project development in that it's committing each of the parties to do certain things to get the project through the pre-FEED stage. And so, you know, we fully expect that, as with any other large project, you will have more decisions, more information, and larger dollars at stake as this proceeds forward. And we're sort of at the starting point of that process where there's some money at stake and you're starting to get more information about the project. I mentioned the...
The percentage of investment is the percentage of the state's investment.
Correct? That's what we're showing here, and it would be proportional to the total project's investment as well. So summarizing here on slide 5 are the key findings from the North Slope Royalty Study that we conducted last year for DNR and the recommendations that come out of that. I have to mention here that we've boiled down to one slide what took us 2 to 3 hearings with those resources as well as Senate's resources. So you're getting the benefit of us having distilled that information down. The main findings were that the global LNG market is growing, and you heard that from Larry just before I was here, and it's competitive. There are a number of projects out there that all find that growing market attractive as well. The government take, as well as the cost structure for the Alaska LNG project, are both high. This will be an expensive project, and our estimated government take can be as high as 70% for this project, which would be a significant cost. The recommendations that came out of those findings were that, one, for this project to achieve commercial success, there's work to be done to improve its commercial attractiveness. And regarding the question of government take, as an objective to aspire to, you want to try and incentivize the project in a way that still retains value to the state. And so one way of doing it, you know, of incentivizing the project would be to reduce the government take. You know, and Larry referred to it when he talked about Canada. You can reduce your royalty, you can reduce your production tax, and that's one way to transfer value to the producers. But a goal that we were trying to achieve is, can we incentivize this project while retaining the state's value? Is there a way for us to participate in the project where we make the project look better for the producers, but we haven't necessarily eroded what the state's revenues would have been from this project under status quo? Moving on to the other key findings, I mentioned this before, but the Alaska LNG project is expected to be a large, complex, and high-cost project. It's actually three mega projects in one. The GTP pipeline and LNG plant each by itself would be considered a complex project. And given that, the project structure is likely to be integrated and producer-owned. The reason that generally happens in the LNG world is that having an integrated project structure improves your project controls. You don't have different owners for different pieces of the supply chain all having to coordinate their schedules and buying equipment and making sure each of the components comes online at the same time. When you have one integrated structure where you have an owner that goes all through the project, that helps to improve your project's controls. And so both from a cost perspective as well as a schedule perspective, that's beneficial.
Senator Dunleavy?
Yes, thanks, Chair. Sorry to interrupt, but will we get to a point where you or somebody will lay out the various models that are in play worldwide now? In other words, what are the different models that are in play in the gas industry, LNG process?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, I am happy to do that now, or we can, I'm happy to have a discussion with you at another time. It's part of what we included in the royalty study. And basically, there are three main structures. The integrated structure that I'm highlighting here is the first one, and it's where you have a single ownership through the entire value chain. And so the same owners own, every piece of that value chain. In this case, it would be the GTP pipeline and LNG plant. A second structure is what's known as a merchant structure. And the way that could work here is that the upstream producers could sell the natural gas to the LNG plant, which is owned by a complete third party. The LNG plant will buy the gas and sell LNG. And so there's a transfer of ownership that happens. And so the LNG plant in that case acts as a merchant, buying gas, selling LNG.
Did you say merchant?
Merchant, yes. And the third most popular structure is a tolling arrangement. And it's tolling. And it's similar to what you see in pipeline contracts generally, where you get paid a service fee to provide a certain service. And so you could set it up to where you're paying the GTP and the pipeline and the LNG plant, a tariff to pass through. But the producers don't necessarily have to have ownership of those three.
Senator Dunleavy?
Through the chair, would we be able to get some type of printout of these three models with various provinces, states, areas that utilize the different models for us to take a look at?
Is that something we get from you?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, yes. That's okay. Something that we can put together for you.
And one last question just for now. We're looking at an integrated model for Alaska.
That's correct.
And can you briefly just explain why that model, and maybe you're going to, why that model best suits our particular circumstance here?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, project control is one of the most important reasons why an integrated project structure works for large, complex, especially high-cost projects, because the sponsors are generally very careful about managing their cost as well as schedule in a project like that. And so the integrated project structure gives them the ability to, start to finish, see that project through. And the other part of why we're saying that the Alaska LNG project will be integrated is that's what the producers have said is their preference for this project.
No, Senator Dunleavy, did you have other questions?
I got a lot of questions, but I'll hold back.
Sure. Ms. Bonnell, go ahead.
Thank you. So some of the implications that come with having an integrated project is, you know, you've heard the benefits of it allowing that control, but the downside of that, especially from the state's perspective, is it could create a black box where we don't have access to information. We are unable to create, you know, any kind of open access for third parties. And from the state's perspective, that's important because, you know, one of the objectives for the state has been to incentivize other exploration and development on the North Slope. And being able to have a means to have third parties enter this project on some future date is important. And if you have a project that's completely controlled by the producers and integrated, one, you don't have access to information on that project, and two, access is not an option. It's just it's an Exxon project or a BP Conoco project. And one of the risks we highlighted for the state is that it could also create misalignment, where because the producers have the upstream as well as midstream, and this is, you know, not with nefarious instinct, but just as part of their fiduciary duties, they're going to transfer revenues to whichever side of that equation increases their take the most, and that is likely to come at a cost to the state. And so, for example, they could make the midstream look really expensive, by having an equity-rich financing arrangement, for example. So the tariff on the project looks really high, which makes your wellhead value low, and it lowers, you know, the royalty and production taxes that the state would receive. And so one of the recommendations then that came from the study was that given that we know that this project is large, complex, and it will have an integrated project structure, that whatever the state engages with the producers should help create alignment with them, where you minimize their incentive to need to behave like that. And then the last finding that I wanted to highlight here is that, there are various risks that are inherent in the project, as well as in the state participating in the project. There are risks whether or not the state participates. The cost structure of the project is a significant risk, and the LNG price is by far the most dominant risk for this project. Given that it's a high-cost project, the project is going to need the global LNG market to sustain this high level of demand and to have prices that are in the healthy teens or above to earn a return that would be attractive for the investors. And
Ms. Bonneville, could I stop you just for a second? We back up just a bit. I'm going to ask kind of an odd question. We hear the word alignment thrown around. I think it has a specific meaning that I may not know. I have my idea of what alignment is. You just said something that sounded like alignment had a specific definition. Could you talk a little about what you think alignment is?
Mr. Chairman, when I think of alignment, I think about all of the parties having a seat at the table, all of the parties having their incentives around a project lined up similarly. And so, the example I gave you before is a good one to highlight where a producer's motivation and incentive from a project could be different from what the state would need from the project. I'm trying to think of another example, but...
Well, you talked a little bit about the black box, and I've heard that discussed before. If you could just run through that again.
Sure. TAPS is probably the best example of this, where, you know, it's a producer-owned oil pipeline, and that has created over the years a number of disputes with the producers at every step of the way on how it should be valued, what the tariff should be going through that project, and all of that happens because it creates a relationship where you're at the opposite sides of the table, right? One party wins, the other loses. And anytime you have that dynamic, it creates inefficiency in the project, essentially. We talked about the economic you know, shifting of revenues between upstream and midstream in a way that could hurt the state. But if you think about some other important objectives to the state from this project, which are open access and being able to allow third parties to bring, you know, to develop the North Slope and bring more oil and gas revenues to the state, that's not necessarily an incentive that the producers would have or an objective that they would have from this project. And there's another example where if the state was not part of the project, you're at the mercy of the producers, essentially, in that respect, in being able to procure access for anybody else into this project.
Senator Dunleavy?
Again, going back, there's different models for reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I heard is that this model seems to be, at this stage of the game, appropriate for Alaska because of the scale.
And complexity.
And there's other projects worldwide in which they use the integrated model, and the concept of alignment is embedded in there, correct?
Yes.
If you have an integrated model, alignment is also part of that, correct? Or not always?
Not always, generally true, I think.
So there are integrated models that are not in alignment.
Well, I want to say that is generally true. When you have an integrated model, it creates alignment. Of course, it depends on who the parties are that are part of that integrated project. You don't always have the state as a participant in those integrated projects. You have just the project sponsors. And they, you know, whoever the producers are, they own the upstream as well as the midstream. It creates alignment between them. It doesn't necessarily create alignment between them and the state or country.
Okay, thanks. Go ahead, Ms. Podwell.
Thank you. And so putting all of the pieces together, the ultimate recommendation of the study was that the state should consider an equity participation as a way of improving the commercial attractiveness of the project, retaining value for the state, and getting something in return for the incentive that you would be providing to the project, and to create alignment between the state and the producers. We looked at different ways of state equity participation, and recommended that participation along the entire value chain would be the most beneficial, again, for the reasons of creating access through the entire value chain and having access to information through the entire value chain.
By the way, I was going to also state, Senator Dunleavy, the questions that you were asking about the different models, that's part of a PowerPoint that you have. That's a much more involved PowerPoint, I think. And if
it is,
and either we can get it to you or you get it from Ms. Podwell. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, starting on slide six, moving to the specifics in the heads of agreement that the state has put in front of you, and measuring that agreement against the criteria in the royalty study. And we're trying to understand here, were each of these objectives met, you know, and to what extent they were met by the heads of agreement. And again, the four criteria that we're looking at here is: one, create alignment through an equity participation; two is help improve the commercial attractiveness of the project; three is preserve value to the state; and fourth is manage associated risks. On slide seven, we look at the first one. Does the HOA create alignment through equity participation? I think the short answer is yes. And the different elements that the HOA defines that get you to that point are, first, it establishes what's the state gas share. And so it's saying we'll take royalty gas and we'll take tax as a gross share of gas, and that together, royalty gas as well as tax gas together, creates your total share of gas from the project. The next concept it lays out is that the state will invest equity in the project that's equal to its gas share. And so each party essentially will have a share of gas and an equivalent share of equity in the project. The equity share that the state has is going to impact both its investment into the project, but also the revenues that the state earns from the project. As as it's envisioned in the HOA, the state would hold equity along the entire supply chain. And the last element here is that the commitments are envisioned to be made in a stage-gated manner. And so we risk fewer dollars up front when we don't have enough information. And as you go through the process and procure more information and more certainty around the project, then the state has, like the producers, more and more dollars at stake. And so between all of those elements, it gets the state to a point where alignment can be achieved, because you're sort of equivalent to the producers in that everyone has a share of the gas and everyone has a share of the entire project. And so you're sort of rowing together in that boat. And as the producers have put it, you know, the state has skin in the game. Next, we look at the objective of improving the commercial attractiveness of the project. And what we're showing here is the impact on the producer rate of return over the project. And the blue bar here shows what the return would be under status quo. I want to stop here and highlight what we're calling modified status quo, just because we're going to be seeing that again in subsequent slides. And modified status quo assumes that there's going to be something that needs to change from a fiscal perspective for gas before this project has any chance at all of moving. And so it assumes that a production credit similar to what's applied on oil gets provided to gas. And so it's a $5 per barrel of oil equivalent credit is applied to gas as well. Okay, so that's the one modification to the world as it is today. And that's the watermark against which we're measuring. Well, if we didn't do that but had an equity participation instead, what does that do for the state? Okay. And so what this shows is that there's an improvement in the producer IRR by 3 to 4% from the state participating in the project. And the main advantage for the producers and what we see here happening in the return is that it reduces their upfront capital costs. Without the state's participation in the project, the producers would have borne 100% of the capital costs associated with this project, but only had, you know, 7/8 of the gas, essentially, right? If you allow for the fact that royalty gas is not really theirs, it's the state's. And so because the state will participate and contribute capital cost up front in the project, what it does is it equates their capital investment to their share of the gas. And that reduction in their upfront capital cost helps to improve their returns over the life of this project. And from a commercial perspective, a couple of other elements that make this more attractive for the producers is that, one, now all of the risks are shared with the state. If there's a capital cost overrun, for example, the state is, you know, going to pick up its share of it as well. And it reduces valuation disputes if the state elects RIK. And, you know, with the RIV world, there's, as we've experienced with TAPS, that is an ongoing burden that both sides have to constantly be working on, establishing what the net back price should be and what the valuation around RIV would be. And so if the state elects to go RIK under the structure, taking away the valuation disputes is another factor that would make the equity participation attractive to the producers. Moving to the third criteria, which is preserving the value to the state from royalty and taxes, there's two principles that are sort of outlined here. The first is To the extent that the state is providing an incentive to the project, is it possible for the state to achieve value in return for that incentive? And then the second is it possible to preserve the state's expected revenues from the project relative to a world without equity participation? And I'm going to walk through a few slides here that present our analysis of whether those two, you know, those two principles have been achieved.
Would you back up and restate those principles?
Sure. On slide 9 here for the record. The first is, to the extent that the state is providing incentives for this project, can the state achieve value in return for that incentive? So rather than just reducing royalty or production tax, if there's a transfer of value from the state side of the table to the producers, can the state get back something in return for that transfer of value? And it goes to the second bullet here, which is saying, can we preserve the revenues that the state would have gotten if we didn't have equity participation and we stayed in an SB 21 fiscal world for this project? Can we match the revenue stream that we would have gotten in that path? What we're showing on slide 10 is a forecast of the state's revenues from the Alaska LNG project under that modified status quo that I talked about, which essentially is simply SB 21 as it is today with a production credit for gas. And I want you to focus on the total cash flows at the bottom. Over this time period that we're looking at here, under the assumptions that are built in here, the state would have made about $70 billion from the Alaska LNG project. To the right of this chart, we're showing the breakup of that total cash flow, the total revenues to the state. And it's showing about 30% of royalty, about 40% production tax, and then the rest of it is made up of property tax and state corporate income tax. Next, when we go to slide 11, we model again what the state's revenues would be with equity participation. Now, one of the things you'll notice right away here is that you have that period of negative revenues or negative cash flows, and that's the equity participation. Pardon me. That's where the state's making an investment into the project. And then starting in 2024, once the project is operational, you start seeing cash flows associated with that. Again, if you go to the bottom line here, what you see is that the state makes, you know, about $72 billion with the equity participation over this time period that we're looking at. And so what that tells us is that at a 25% equity participation, which is what we've modeled here, the state's making about as much as you would have made without equity participation in the project. It's a little bit better in this case, and when we get to the next slide, I'll talk a little bit more about that. What does happen is that the makeup of those revenues changes. If you look on the right, your royalty value is preserved and, in fact, actually increases. Your property tax decreases, and that's because now 25% of the project does not pay property tax, because it's state-owned. But that gets compensated by what we're calling the project ownership of midstream revenues. It's the returns that you would earn from the investment in the midstream itself. And so while the makeup of the different components of the revenue change, overall, at a 25% participation in the project, the state is able to preserve the value that it would have earned without the equity participation. Please do stop me if we need to go over that again. I'm happy to. I know it's sort of a lot of information, and it's about to get a little bit more complicated here. What we're looking at on slide 12 is one of the big questions when you say, you know, here's an idea, participate with equity in the project, is how much equity, right? What is a good range for the state to start talking about equity participation in the project, where it makes sense for the producers and it makes sense for the state. And that's the question that we try to answer here. And one of the key things for us all to understand is that there are so many uncertainties associated with this project that it's hard to pin down one number and say, well, this is the number to beat, right? Because it's going to depend on the capital cost of the project. It's going to depend on the market prices. All of that will impact what royalty earnings the state would have had, what production tax earnings the state would have had. And so recognizing that there's all of that uncertainty, the objective really is to try and get to the ballpark. You know, is it in the 20s? Is it in the teens? Is it 40%? How much equity do we need, and how much of the gas does the state need to have an arrangement with the producers where we're not losing value? And so what 12 looks at are different scenarios of capital costs for the project as well as market prices. And under each of those scenarios, it is trying to solve for what is the equity participation level where the revenues we would have made without equity participation, just staying with SB 21, would match the revenues that the state would make with equity participation. And so if you look at the number at the very center of this graph, which is the 24%, in the previous slide here, we're assuming a 25% equity participation, and you'll see that the number at the bottom is just a little bit better than the status quo number, which was the $68 billion in the previous slide. If we had modeled a 24% equity participation, those two should essentially have been equal. And so that's what the numbers on slide 12 mean. It's what is that number of, you know, the percentage of equity where the status quo world as well as your revenues from the equity participation world are equal. And the bottom line here is that somewhere in that 20 to 30% seems like the right ballpark to for the state to participate with equity in the project. At a low price scenario, which is you know a high risk case for the state, if you have 20, you know, somewhere in the 20s equity participation, the state is getting a higher share of the gas than it would have needed to match its revenues under an SB 21 world. And so you've improved your position in that very risky scenario for the state. At a high price, everyone's making money anyway. And so even if you didn't match what you would have made at SB 21 at 25%, you're still making a lot of money. That's, you know, in some ways a good problem to have at that point. And so what you really want to plan around are your low price and base prices and make sure that in that world we haven't lost revenues to the state from the level of equity participation that we've undertaken. And that takes us to the next concept that I want to highlight here on 13, which is that the level of equity participation is going to be determined by the gross tax that this legislature will decide on. Because your royalty is somewhat fixed, right? It's at or around 13%. And because your share of the gas is equal to the share of equity, the variable there is how much tax gas do you take? So if royalty is at 13, then depending on these different levels of tax gas that we've shown here, that gets you to a 20% or a 22% or a 25% share of equity in the project. So if we want a 25% equity share in the project, that means your gross gas share has to be 14%. And that plays through here all the way to the boxes on the very right, you know, and that's going to drive how much investment the state's going to have to make in the project as well. Recognizing that as you take on a greater equity share, the investment requirement from the state is going to go up as well. Moving on to the next recommendation and objective, which is manage your risks, right? The first risk that I want to highlight here is price exposure. We pointed this out in the royalty study. Price is by far, you know, there are lots of distant seconds, but price is by far the first and biggest risk factor to this project. It's a huge driver of the revenues that the project will make. And so what this is showing is, again, those same different levels of, you know, market variables and uncertainties. We're looking at capital costs, a range of capital costs, as well as a range of prices, and trying to understand under each of these what the total cash flows to the state would be, okay? And I want to point out here a couple of things. Let's look at the set of results on the far left that all correspond to a low price environment. And what we'll see there is that the green bars, which all represent a world where the state has equity participation in the project, are all higher than the blue bars. And what that's simply saying is that under low price environment, the state would earn more with equity participation than it would have earned without the equity participation. And so equity participation dampens the state's risk exposure under a low price environment. The flip side of that are the set of bars to the very right. And you'll notice there that the green bars are all lower than the blue bars. And what that's saying is, under a high price environment, the state's revenues are going to be lower than what you would have without the equity participation. So you're losing some of the upside as well. In general, what the equity participation is doing is that it's flattening the state's revenue profile, its exposure to these different market environments. And that is driven by the fact that part of the state's revenues are going to be dependent on, you know, are earned from the midstream and your return on that investment. And those are not price sensitive. And so because you've introduced that component of revenues to the state that don't fluctuate with prices, it helps to flatten your profile. The next risk exposure is that of capital costs and cost overruns. And they are a very, very real risk for this project as well. Almost all of the projects that have that have achieved FID and are currently under construction are all going over their budget. It's because there's significant competition for resources, and it's pushing up your labor costs, it's pushing up your material costs. I mean, and some of these projects are managed by, you know, some of the best companies in the world, but it's just the market changing. And we do expect that, given the scale of the Alaska project, that cost overruns can be a very real risk here. What we're looking at is, and from the state's perspective, the highest risk exposure is prior to the project start. That's when there are cash calls.
I thought I did misheard you, and then I heard what you said. Go ahead.
Okay, sorry. Prior to project start, when there are cash calls on the state, that is the biggest exposure that the state has. Because once the project is in operation, there are going to be revenues that are coming that will support any cost that the project has. But the initial period, especially during that construction period that we talked about, where you're spending 95% of the project's costs, when there are cost overruns, the state is essentially exposed 100% to absorbing those. The participation by TransCanada that's envisioned by the administration allows the state to offset some of those capital cost exposures up front to TransCanada. The assuming that TransCanada takes the state's equity position in the GTP as well as the pipeline, or 60% of the state's equity in the GTP and the pipeline, and the state retains the rest of it as well as the LNG plant, what that works out to is that the state can still keep 20 to 25% of the gas share, but only be responsible for between 13 and 18% of the project's costs, the upfront costs, because TC is going to bear the remaining costs. And this becomes, you know, needless to say, even more important when you have cost overruns, because those are percentages of a bigger number. And just to put numbers in context, if we move to slide 16, that shows what the state's total investment in the project would be if it went alone, which is the blue line, or if it was in the deal with TransCanada in the picture. On the left here, we're showing sort of the midway estimate for this project at $45 billion. And at that level, having TransCanada as part of the deal reduces the state's upfront cash investment by about $3 billion. When you move to the lines on the right of the graph, which is assuming a cost overrun, and you get to a $54 billion project, you've had a 20% cost overrun, then that reduces the state's cash call, so the investment that the state would be making toward the project, by $4 billion, having TC in the mix. And so it's material, the impact that having TC in the picture can have in reducing just the raw exposure that the state would have before we have an operational project. Moving on to slide 17, the third risk that we're talking about here is the potential loss of value through moving to royalty in kind. And this is something that the royalty study dealt with in a lot of detail. But the bottom line of the highlighted risk was that if the state goes royalty in kind, and the state is now, you know, Alaska LNG Marketing Co. trying to market this LNG in the global market, it is going to likely suffer a loss of value because, one, the state does not have any expertise in marketing global, you know, LNG to the global market, and two, you're competing with some of the best companies in the world that do this for a living. If the state had state royalty in value, then those best companies in the world would be marketing that gas for you, essentially, and giving you a portion of the value that they achieve. But moving to royalty in kind takes away that advantage and exposes the state, you know, and could expose the state pretty meaningfully to an erosion in the price negotiated. The HOA includes some intent from the producers where they offer to negotiate individually with the state to market the state's share of the gas. And the state is only obligated to elect RIK if the state feels like satisfactory arrangement, I'm quoting from the HOA here, satisfactory arrangements for the disposition of the state's share of LNG has been made. Having the producers market the state's share of the gas would be beneficial and could recreate the marketing benefit that royalty, that staying in royalty in value could have. Because in you know, conceptually, the state's share of the LNG will be bundled along with the producer's LNG and all marketed together. And so the state would achieve the benefits of their marketing expertise and their negotiation. So if that is resolved, you know, if that negotiation between the producer and the state is resolved to where the state's happy with the terms of that arrangement, it could be a very effective way for the state to mitigate the risk of being exposed on the global LNG market alone with LNG to sell. And then moving to slide 18, one of the, you know, one entire area of risks that were highlighted in the royalty study were that the devil's in the details. In principle or in theory, it sounds like a good idea to have equity participation. Everyone has an equal share of the gas, equal share of equity, and away we go. We're all lined up. But the details of the terms that are included there could really either help the state achieve its various objectives or not. Objectives like enabling access, enabling the project to be expanded, having access to information. And so the HOA does include different elements that start, saying the right things about how you achieve all of those objectives. It contemplates a framework of a project within a project, where essentially the state's share of the project, you could almost theoretically think of that as a separate project by itself. The state will, through its negotiations with TransCanada, set its own tariff for that part of the project. The state can expand its part of the project. The expansion principles, that the pro-expansion principles that have been included in the HOA, essentially say that any party can expand the project as long as it's not to the detriment of what the other parties achieve from the project. In other words, the combination of the state and TransCanada can solicit an expansion in the project, and unless the other parties can prove that it's somehow operationally or otherwise affecting their operations, they have to agree to that expansion. And so if you have an Anadarko or some other company in the future that has discoveries and wants to be able to monetize that gas, it creates an avenue for the state to be able to facilitate that. The state entity that would be the holder of the equity in the project would have access to the information, the same information that the producers would have access to. And the concept of having, again, stage-gated commitments where the state is only committing at each stage to, you start with a small commitment and then it goes to a bigger commitment and a bigger commitment. As each party gets access to more information about the project and as you increase the certainty around the capital cost of the project, around the market that's out there for the project, it's a very prudent approach to project development. It's what you would see anywhere in the world. You're not making a one-time commitment on, these are all the dollars that we will commit to this project and this is how the fiscals will be laid out. We're not quite making all of those commitments up front. What the HOA leads the state to is, can we get through pre-FEED together and find out more about the project?
Senator Dunleavy?
That's true. I mean, obviously it's true. But when you look at page 4, you're committing capital at various steps.
At the first step, you're committing the capital, first part of the capital.
Right. Yeah. And if you want to get out of it, you commit a capital. The capital's gone.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair. Yes.
Then you go to the second step, and you're committing capital.
Correct.
So, yes, you're not committing all of it up front, but each step costs money to keep going.
That's correct, and it's consistent with how, these large projects are developed, and it's part of what makes the state's participation attractive to the producers is everyone has money, skin in the game. Everyone has money on the table proportionately. And the other thing, and Larry alluded to this as well, is that it's quite significant that the producers are in the mix here. And they are, depending on what the state's equity share is, going to be putting up 75 to 80% of this project's cost through each stage of the process as well. That is definitely a positive sign that the market sees it like that. I will say here that, all of these elements that the HOA lay out are, what I would think of as principles. The details need to get worked out as we get to the commercial agreements that are ahead for the state. And so this is a work in progress as it's normal for it to be a work in progress at this stage of the project. But it's something that needs to actively be managed between now and when these commercial arrangements are made, that all of these principles and the objectives that the state has from the project actually come through in the commercial agreements that are ahead.
Senator Dunleavy?
Mr. Chair, just a clarification. We're looking at four partners or five? In other words, is TransCanada and the state sharing a singular partnership? In other words, there's a we have BP.
We're partners.
Name the partners.
So you have the parties to the HOA are the three producers, the state, AGDC, as well as TransCanada. And I'll stop your intern here and see if that's right. Yes.
Say that again one more time, please.
The three producers, so it's Exxon, BP, right. And Conoco.
Right.
AGDC.
Four.
The state, represented by DNR and DOR. And TransCanada.
So there's six separate partners in this arrangement.
Okay,
thank you.
Is that a correct way to characterize it? I thought it was the three producers plus the state and the state AGDC and TransCanada as a partner. What's a partnership within a partnership?
The six parties that I mentioned are all the signatories to the HOA, and they're all the different parties at the table in some sense. The specific arrangement would be for each of the producers to have, you know, their own share through the project of the gas as well as the midstream, for the state to have its share through the midstream, through AGDC, you know, as it's envisioned now, and for TransCanada to participate through the state's equity participation in the project. And so the state would bequeath to TransCanada a portion of its equity in the GTP as well as pipeline.
Senator Bishop?
Might be a play on words, but I like joint venture between TransCanada and the state. Would that be accurate, too?
Senator Bishop, through the chair. I don't want to misrepresent the legalese, because I know there's a number of different arrangements that are being contemplated here. I will defer to either the state's legal team or the administration to, you know, characterize the arrangements.
Senator Dunleavy, I'm having a hard time saying
your name. Four participants. There's four participants, but possibly six entities.
I think that's a good characterization.
All right, go ahead. Senator Faircliffe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to go back. You used the word bequeath, and that sounds like a gift. So could you please expand on that or elaborate?
Okay. Senator Faircloth through the chair. Thank you for asking that question, because as I said it, I was like, maybe that was not the right word. What the state will be doing in its arrangement with TransCanada is assigning a portion of the equity, of its share of the equity, to TransCanada. And, you know, there's different aspects of that transaction where TransCanada will pay the upfront costs associated with its portion, and the state enters into a commercial arrangement with TransCanada to pay TransCanada a tariff for, you know, through the GTPN pipeline. I do want to say that we're coming back on Friday and going to delve deeper into that specific transaction with TransCanada, and so I'll be able to walk you through then, you know, much more detail on that.
Thank you, and I certainly can hold until that point, but I'd like you to make sure that when we talk about that, we talk about whether there's value to the state of Alaska for that assignment of shares to TransCanada, and I am hopeful that that's part of that conversation.
Yes, it will be. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So slide 19, we're essentially summarizing, you know, sort of the scorecard for the HOA, have the different recommendations and objectives that the royalty study laid out been met, or how the HOA addresses those. Alignment through equity, again, to summarize, the equity participation along the entire supply chain is positive to achieve alignment. And taking your royalty and tax as a share of the gas, again, creates a situation where each party has an equivalent part of the gas as well as equivalent share in the project. improving commercial attractiveness, we looked at the producer IRR, as you may recall, and, you know, the arrangement improves the producer returns from the project and potentially reduces their risk because the state is now sharing some of that. While improving the commercial attractiveness and attractiveness of this project for the producers, the arrangement, could preserve value for the state as well. And I use the word could there because it depends on what the final equity share would be, right? And recognizing that what we're trying to do with that equity share is to get to the right ballpark. And regarding each of the risks that were highlighted as we walked through these, equity participation does help to dampen the exposure that the state has to prices from the project. And, we talked about how having those midstream earnings makes a portion of the state's revenues, not fluctuate with prices and helps to flatten the state's revenue profile. TC's participation lowers the state's cash calls in the years prior to commercial operation, and that's one of the ways that the capital cost exposure has been reduced. With the producer offer to negotiate to market the state's share of the gas, the exposure to the state marketing its own gas under RIK has been contemplated here. And the structure of the participation, again here, the project within a project, having stage-gated commitments, so we're not making one big commitment up front, having pro-expansion principles where each party can expand the project if it wants to, and securing access to information. I would characterize, the colors towards the right of this graph are trying to get to what's the level to which these objectives have been achieved in the HOA. And structurally, the alignment and helping to improve the commercial attractiveness by reducing the producer's upfront cost and preserving value to the state, the HOA, I would say, has been fairly successful at moving in the right direction towards achieving those objectives. With the managing risks, there's elements of the HOA that are trying to get there, and they will remain a work in progress. And it's given where the project is right now, you cannot completely mitigate those risks. But there are elements in the HOA that start laying out the principles towards where the state can manage those risks. And it's something that this body, as well as the administration, should keep your eyes on in how the actual commercial arrangements will play out to be able to achieve all of the state's objectives. With that, I conclude my testimony. I'll take more questions if we have any.
Thank you. It is almost exactly 7 o'clock. If we have some quick questions, let's do it. We have a lot of time in front of us to get into this fairly deeply. I wanted a general overview, which you've given us, and I appreciate it. It's very, very informative. Questions from the committee? And Mr. Yeah, Mr. Destichter, did you have anything to add to this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jason Destichter with Black and Veatch for the record. I did not have anything to add. I am available here for questions of a more detailed nature, if need be.
All right, then, without any questions, thank you so much for your presentation. I certainly appreciate it. Tomorrow morning, I believe, do we have it tomorrow morning?
Yeah.
9 o'clock, normal 9 o'clock meeting, and I don't have a list of what's up. And then we'll do another meeting tomorrow night, and we will be, stand by just a moment. I'll tell you tomorrow at the finance meeting in the morning what we're doing in the evening. Without any further comments, thank you and have a good night.